The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read their pieces for you. This week we'll have Leo McKinstry talking about why social care should be paid for by the family. Then we'll be joined by Emily Hill as she looks forward to the return of hugging, or not. And finally, Daisy Dunn will be talking about the art of asparagus. First, Leo McKinstry.
The sound of the well-off grumbling about their finances is always an unattractive one, but there's one gripe that has become particularly powerful, filling the airwaves and shaping public policy. This is the persistent, ever louder complaint from many households that they are required to sell the family home to pay the costs of care for a close relative. It is a practice widely seen as a scandal, where the state seizes private property because of its own failure to create a properly funded care system that meets the needs of the elderly. The flames of grievance are stoked by the press, pressure groups and politicians who promote the belief that all social care should be free or at least massively subsidised. The campaign body Age UK moans that 167,000 older people now have to fund their own care because they do not meet the brutal means test. One newspaper recently screeched about the betrayal of the middle class. Sensing the mood, Boris Johnson declared when he became Prime Minister in 2019 that my job is to protect you and your parents and grandparents from having to sell your home to pay the costs of care. High COVID death rates in care homes highlighted the need for comprehensive reform in this sector. For campaigners, such change should mean a vast new injection of cash that will end the injustice of the expropriation of assets by the government. In March, Johnson pledged a 10-year plan for social care, while last month Matt Hancock confirmed that social care reforms would be implemented before the end of this year, though there was only a brief, vague mention of the government's plan in the Queen's speech this week. The indignation is driven by the requirement that any residents with savings or assets of less than £14,250 are entitled to free care, whereas those marginally above this threshold have to pay a share of the costs, while those with capital of more than £23,250 have to meet their bills in full. Under this rule, it is estimated that 17,000 older people have had to sell their homes in the past year, up 45% since 2000. This might be an emotional wrench for families, but it cannot really be described as a scandal. Indeed, the cry of free care for all involves a far greater unfairness, since such a measure could only be paid for by a huge rise in taxation. In practice, hard-pressed wage earners would have to fork out more to enable richer households to keep their wealth intact. Behind the rhetoric about inequity lies the determination of many of the affluent to protect their inheritances. Why should other taxpayers be hammered to uphold these private ambitions? In a society where the average full-time weekly pay is just £586, the equivalent of £30,472 a year, many of those targeted for additional bills will not even own their own homes, nor enjoy anything like the affluence of the inheritors. It is a twisted kind of entitlement to believe that the government has a duty to provide free care so that the better off can safeguard their legacies. There is vast private wealth in this country, partly due to the explosion in the value of property, with the over 65s accounting for almost half of the money in housing. According to one estimate, total household net wealth was £14.6 trillion in December 2019. The pandemic has only accelerated this trend, with house prices rising by no less than 8.6% over the 12 months to February. Inheritances are part of this pattern. A study last year by the Institute for Fiscal Studies estimated that as property values surge, the median inheritance for those born in the 1980s has risen to £136,000, more than double the £66,000 for those born in the 1960s. Many receive far more. The IFS analysis revealed that one quarter of people born in the 1980s have parents with an estate per heir, that is after dividing it between their children, of 300,000 or more. It is only right that some of this wealth should be tapped to pay for social care. Such an argument is an affront to the Inheritance Protection Brigade. They want none of the financial responsibilities for care and all of the advantages of a free system. The most blinkered wail that their parents worked hard to pass something on, but soaring property prices provide a classic example of unearned wealth. They gripe about the state's generosity to those without any assets, but want the wealthy to become the biggest welfare claimants of all. There is undoubtedly a care crisis in Britain, but the political focus on protecting property has thwarted attempts at sustainable reform. In a sense, it is the middle classes who have betrayed the system with their narrow self-interest. When, in 2010, Labour came up with a perfectly sensible proposal for an inheritance surcharge to pay for long-term care, it was immediately denounced by their opponents as a death tax. The party went down to a heavy defeat. In 2017, Theresa May set out a plan by which people needing social care would have to pay for it until the value of their assets, including their homes, reached a floor of £100,000. Nicknamed the dementia tax, the idea prompted such a furious reaction that it almost ushered Jeremy Corbyn into power. Since then, ministers have been too paralysed to act. But a free care system is not the answer. There's no cost-free panacea, as is demonstrated by how other countries have grappled with the problem. Japan's system, to which everyone over 40 has to contribute, is funded by a mix of taxation, age-based premiums, and user co-payments. In Germany, everyone has to contribute to their future costs from the moment they start working, either to the government's own programme or to private health insurance. In the UK, some argue that private insurance could be the way to spread the cost and avoid enforced home sales. But that is not practical because private insurers refuse to provide suitable products. A more realistic suggestion was put forward in March by Lord Lilly, the former Social Security Secretary. In a paper for the think tank Civitas, he urged the creation of a not-for-profit company owned and guaranteed by the state, which would offer everyone approaching state pension age the opportunity to take out insurance against the need to finance from their own home or other assets the costs of social care. The charge, which would be a small fraction of the property's value, perhaps as low as £16,000, would only be realised when the owner dies or the home is sold. That offers a workable, affordable way out of the current mess, if only some of the middle class would drop their obsession with maximising their inheritances.
That was Leo McKinstry, and now Emily Hill.
On Monday, the Prime Minister says, we can hug again. Personally, I never stopped. But then I've been corrupted by the southerners, foreigners, posh boys and gorgeous homosexuals. In Loveyland, aka London and Twitter, there's this perception that everyone is desperate to rush into one another's arms because they've desisted for so long. In many places outside the M25, that idea is so nuts, it's comical. In Norfolk, where I was raised, most people meet with a nod and a grunt, and it is the height of good manners not to look at anyone funny. In other words, we don't make eye contact with strangers. If any outsider tries to offer a hug next week, they'll likely get clobbered. For those of us who like hugging, Monday's easing of restrictions will be embraced. But there's no convincing those who don't like it. And if you're from the Shires, you're sure to have relatives who despise it. My great-aunt Mavis gave about as many hugs as the Queen, says my friend Anna, estimating the number of hugs the Queen gives at zero. Dead reliable, rescued my mother as a teenager, but no tactility. If she were feeling affectionate, the furthest she'd go was calling her ducky. Hugging is the worst, and I hate people who hug, a former colleague confesses. Now it's going to be grim, because even the people who don't normally hug you will feel they have to do so. It makes me want to go back in my cave so I don't have to face it. In 2016, there was even a concerted campaign by some Remainers to go around hugging anyone who wanted to leave the EU. And we all know how that turned out. Hugging has been forcibly repelled, even at the ballot box. As a child, I can't remember getting any hugs from my father except once, when he handed me a rape alarm on the day he shooed me off to university. Never in all my years did I see him hug my mother, and for this reason, biblical accounts of conception had previously made sense. Live and let live, repression is okay. In my home village of Blakeney, population 801, interlopers make fools of themselves with their airy-fairy affections cast about willy-nilly where they're not wanted. One man, shortly before becoming my uncle, went so far as to kiss my mother on the cheek upon meeting her. He was lucky my father didn't make my mother carry a rape alarm, because she'd have set it off. My aunt didn't like kissing or hugging any better than my mother did. Years later, when she was in the late stages of pregnancy, and my uncle must have felt her defences had been weakened, he had the temerity to hug her right in front of me. Her response was to whip up a wet tea towel and hit him. My handsomest man friend has a dad who loathes hugging too. We know a Turkish guy who gives him hugs. He's livid afterwards, says my friend. But the Turkish guy doesn't realise because he's British. The pandemic has in some ways been convenient for anti-huggers, who can blame their opposition to it on dread of infection. For years I've been recoiling from people's embraces, writer Martha Frankel admitted in The Guardian. In 2008, I got the flu, and bad. What I experienced during those 3 weeks absolutely terrified me. I feared I would die. That next winter, I noticed how people would cough into their hands and still try to shake mine, or they would rub their noses and then lean in for a kiss. Don't even get me started on little children, those snot machines. But for most people, I suspect, not wanting to hug anyone has pretty much nothing to do with germophobia or a loathing of kids. Hugging is a word that may have entered our language in the 16th century, but prior to Princess Diana's era, it just wasn't a public spectacle. Like public crying, it was generally seen as vulgar, perhaps American, and only really became a thing forcibly imposed on us by New Labour after Diana's death. Anyone who has retained a stiff upper lip should beware come Monday. There will be compulsive huggers about, looking to share the joy. Those on the other side should make sure they stay rigid as an ironing board, even in the midst of a bear hug, for fear of encouraging more.
That was Emily Hill. And finally, Daisy Dunn on asparagus.
Manet's Botte d'Asperge are probably the most famous asparagus in the world. The artist painted the delicious white and lilac-tinged spears for the collector Charles Effroussi in 1880, before invoicing him for 800 francs. Effroussi was so delighted with them that he paid Manet 1,000 instead, to which Manet responded by sending a second picture. "One appears to have escaped your bunch," the painter quipped in his accompanying note. The new canvas featured a single asparagus. Manet was in the last decade of his life when he began sending small paintings of fruit and flowers to his friends. While Effroussi received asparagus, the muse Marie Laurent got apples, and artist Berta Morisot violets, like those Manet had included in his portrait of her in mourning. Each picture offered something lasting. "I would have given you the real thing," Manet seems to say, "but they'd only have rotted away." There is nothing quite like asparagus. By the time you have your first bunch simmering in the pan, you can be sure that it's spring and that nothing, not even rain, can stop you from enjoying it. For artists, too, asparagus have proved utterly irresistible. The soft paintbrush tips and stalks like stegosauri with their green and purple spikes, lending interest to dozens of paintings besides Manet's. For the dark background of his Botte d'Asperge, the Frenchman drew inspiration from the artists of the Dutch Golden Age, who were just as enamoured of the vegetable as he was. The little-known Middelburg artist, Adrian Quarter, active 1683 to 1707, perhaps gloried in asparagus above any other. Typically working on paper, mounted on panels measuring just 20 to 30 centimetres, Quarter produced a number of exquisite still lives, most of which lay forgotten until the 20th century. While his contemporaries celebrated profusion, painting extravagant spreads of food too abundant to eat, Quarter favoured what was small and unpretentious. He found beauty in a handful of common medlars, in gooseberries from the market, in wild strawberries still trailing the vine. But most of all, he found profundity in asparagus. Korte painted it repeatedly, sometimes with strawberries, sometimes with red currants or cherries. He was by no means restricted by seasonal availability. His beautifully lit study of asparagus with a butterfly glows on the salmon-pink wall of Kunsthaus Zurich. In the Rijksmuseum, Korte's asparagus are alone, huge and cigar-like. Look closely, and you might even say there were bombs in a futurist painting. One spear droops pitifully over the edge of the table. The whole bunch, in fact, looks perilously close to rolling to the floor. Korte almost always pushed his composition to the very corner of the table or ledge, as if to symbolise the uncertainty of life. In ancient Rome, and especially at Pompeii, asparagus was seen to be paradigmatic of the fertility of the countryside. Many wealthy homeowners had it depicted in their wall frescoes and mosaics. Asparagus grew so abundantly in the wild, as it still does in parts of Italy and Greece, that Pliny could complain of the wantonness of cultivating giant specimens. "The gluttony," he exclaimed on hearing of asparagus weighing 3 pounds. Asparagus may be found dripping in shrimp butter or hollandaise in some of the nicest restaurants today, but historically it has often been celebrated as a humble vegetable. On the table between Christ and the two disciples in Giovanni Battista Piazzetta's supper at Emmaus, 1720, where we would usually see bread, we find a large plate of glowing white asparagus. The succulent spears, by no means intended to denote luxury, come as quite a surprise to those of us used to seeing them on menus for £20. Artists have just occasionally explored asparagus's phallic potential. Max Ernst's sculpture, Les Asperges de la Lune, designed in 1935, plays on the fact that the French for asparagus, seen as an aphrodisiac for centuries, can also mean penis. Ernst's giant erect asparagus may equally evoke the truly bizarre way in which real asparagus grow. Visit a farm and you'll find hundreds of individual spears poking their heads through the soil like members of a miniature Theban army. Even when cooked, asparagus are, it must be said, decidedly odd-looking. In shape and tone they challenge the palate in much the same way as they do the palate. It is perhaps not surprising that Proust took such an interest in them. Inspired, some believe, by his friend Charles Afrussi, Proust had Elstir, the artist, produce a painting like Manet's in A la recherche du Trompadour and offer to sell it to the Duc de Gramont. 300 francs, une botte d'asperges, exclaimed the Duke. You can bet it was worth every centime.
That was Daisy Dunn. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. And if you like this podcast or any of our other podcasts, please do leave a rating and a review and tell your friend about it as well. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.